And welcome to another exciting episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night here at Planet FM 104.6 or live stream planetaudio.org.nz/kickarts. I'm Richard Green. I'm your host all alone tonight. Well, not alone. There's six people in the studio, but my co-host Georgia has failed to return from the sunny north on a holiday, so I'm home alone running the show by myself. But I've got the next best thing, because we've got a long-time listener, long-time chatter, long-time guest, Ahi from Short and Sweet, who's in here. Ahi, you can stand in as my co-host if you like. That means you have to say witty things. Can you do
witty
that?
Witty things. I think I can step up to the challenge.
Yeah, you can do that. Witty.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll also let you talk about Short and Sweet as
cool.
Well.
Awesome.
And next to you, well, because as the co-host, you want to introduce Alan.
Yeah, absolutely. So on to my right, I've got Alan here. He's here from Short and Sweet, and he's going here to talk about Short and Sweet film.
Hello.
So Short and Sweet film, that's new.
Yep.
So we had dance. We've had dance. We've got theatre. And now we've got film.
Yes, that's right.
So you have to make a film in 10 minutes?
Yeah, 10 minutes under, as long as you know your own rights, and it's interesting material, we want to see it.
Okay. Is it the same process, people write scripts and give them to filmmakers, or do you just...
We're looking for films that are already completed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got one.
Oh, go for it.
I have to. It's a 2 hours and 59 minutes, so I'll have to cut it down a little bit. I'll just do a bit of editing. Cut it every third word.
Yeah.
Well, I did a funding application once, and the feedback from the funding agency, I won't name them, was the script was too long. And I thought, okay, I'll just cut out every third word. That would work. It came out quite good.
Nice.
Yeah, it was more intelligent than some Hollywood blockbusters. Right, moving right along. Bit of self-deprecation there. Moving right along, we've got, now I'm going to say this, I'm going to try and say this, them South Africans, which is how it's spelled, isn't it, Robin?
The South Africans.
The South Africans.
Yes, but there's freak in the middle. There.
Freak?
Yeah.
But it almost fits, South African.
Yeah, well, generally when people try and say the name, they'll try and adopt a South African accent, so it's quite nice. It's a nice little hook to get people interested.
And this is your heritage, though, isn't it? Both your parents are South African.
Yeah, so this is my solo show that I'm performing, and it is based on my parents. So it's a monologue performed as a duologue, and I play both of my parents. So I play my mum and my dad. And it's the story of our immigration from South Africa to New Zealand. And so it's a comedy, but it's got these underlying themes of like home and displacement and kind of looking for where you belong when you leave the land where you're from.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do your parents feel about this? We could probably get into a bit of a discussion about that
At first, they were highly apprehensive about this. But they're secretly stoked to be like immortalized in this play. And they came to Edinburgh because we did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last year. And they came along and they really love it. So.
What an excuse. I'm going to Edinburgh to see my life story played out in front of strangers.
They were there for like 4 hours and they went off and did like an old person's camper van trip.
An old person's camper van trip. Yeah. Be intrigued to know exactly what that is. Paula, welcome to the show.
Kia ora.
Now, kia ora, the Phantom Bill Stickers, I have to say that, don't I, because they've got the naming rights for it. The Phantom Bill Stickers, who many people in the arts use, don't they, for putting posters up. I've said it three times now, Phantom Bill Stickers, National Poetry Day. You're curating, is that the correct word?
Well, I'm implicated in it, yes. I'm Paula Morris and I'm on the New Zealand Book Awards Trust. Mm. And we organise, as well as various book awards, we organise National Poetry Day, which is on the 25th of August, a Friday this year. And it's the 20th anniversary, so it's kind of a big deal. But yes, Phantom Bill Stickers are our sponsor.
Oh, it's good on them. Good on them.
And every time you say their name, we get another dollar, so that's good.
Oh, Phantom Bill Stickers. Good on you, Phantom Bill Stickers. Well done, Phantom Bill Stickers. Ah, that's almost like two sides of the same coin. That was a really awful segue into Jekyll and Hyde, wasn't it? Running, getting lost on the way.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
That's fine.
We had an agreement with Google Maps.
Yeah, well, don't listen to Google Maps. They'll send you through. Apparently there's a tunnel here somewhere that's confusing the hell out of everybody. They can't either get off it or on it. So, yes. Susie.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So which one are you tonight?
A bit of column A, a bit of column B.
Okay.
Yes.
Good, because I just need to know who I'm talking to. Jekyll
totally.
Or Hyde.
Yes.
You can tell us a little bit about the show.
Yeah,
a little bit
totally.
Yeah.
I'm an actor and divisor of the work with the company A Slightly Isolated Dog. And this is our second work that we've made kind of in this style, which is really explosive and kind of like a party that tells a story. So we take something generally, maybe not necessarily super well-known, but kind of a classic text. So we originally started with Don Juan by Molière and completely kind of extracted and exploded out from there. So, yeah.
Don Juan to Jekyll and Hyde.
Yes.
It's a big leap. I love both those stories, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jekyll and Hyde, there's a film that was made, I think, in the 60s of it, which I saw, not in the 60s because I wasn't alive then, but but it was, it stuck with me. I would have been in my early teens. I can't remember who the actor was in it, but it was pretty bloody good.
Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of take on what we do when we have urges to do things and a man that's trying to figure out how to be his best self, but also do all the things that he feels he wants to do. And so, we've kind of taken that little nugget that's within the story and kind of exploded out from there.
Two sides to everybody. Hey, there's film and there's theatre and there's dance. Hey, short and sweet. Oh, Hannah and John.
Hi.
Kia ora and welcome to Kick Arts. So I told you we had a full house tonight. And Puppet Fiction.
Yeah.
So Puppet Fiction is that like pulp fiction but with puppets?
That's exactly. It is literally pulp fiction with strings attached.
With strings attached.
It is. It's an homage.
Yeah.
We've taken somebody else's story as well.
Yeah.
And created our own version of it with in miniature in many ways.
Mm.
And it's an impossible task.
Yeah, we revise that impossibility every festival and show we do.
Yeah. So we've been doing the show. I think we've worked out that by the end of this year, the show would have been performed 300 times.
Wow.
And every time is different because there's so much improvisation and puppet mishap as part of it. But
puppet mishap.
Yeah. Mm. So John had this idea about 6 years ago now, maybe longer, to... He said, Hannah, I want to make Pulp Fiction with puppets. And I said, that's ridiculous. That'll never work. Why would... don't be crazy.
Feel stupid now?
And then, and then I sort of woke up in the middle of the night and was like... I just woke my partner up. I was like, I figured it out!
Yeah, just dumb enough to work.
And now we've been doing it for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. So are you puppeteers or actors? Or
I am. Puppeteer and... Basically self-trained.
We like to call him the Puppet Master.
Yeah, I don't want to throw that N-word around.
Is that a Stephen King book?
Oh.
The Puppet Master? Quite a scary King.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It?
It's great.
Yeah, okay. It gets a bit scary sometimes. Yeah. Very close with the puppets. And then we have comedian James Nikise in the show and actor Anya Tate Manning. So the three of them and their different skill sets combined to just create some pretty amazing magic, actually.
It's up to 20 odd puppets now. Yeah. I can't keep track.
John keeps making new puppets, so we get cameos.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm the director of the show, and I am quite often surprised by who turns up.
Oh. When Gandalf shows up in Pulp Fiction, you know something's off track.
Yeah, I can see it, though. It's a possibility, really, isn't it? Anything's possible in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Have you kept true to the story?
Yeah, so what we originally did was broke out, because it is a movie of three stories, we broke it into what we call the episodes, where we create, as in a 1 hour show, we would normally create one of those episodes. So when we do it in Edinburgh Fringe Festival, we do a different episode every day, so people have to come three times.
Oh, nice marketing.
Good marketing boy.
But here in Auckland, we're doing a super special season. We're doing what we call our marathon, which is where we attempt to recreate the entire film. And we have a bar break and a loo break in the middle.
Yeah. That's always good, eh?
Yeah.
I like you when you do that, people. You know, sometimes I can't sit for 2 hours and a half hours and see a... I went to the Pop-Up Globe. How many people went to the Pop-Up Globe? Anyone?
Austria.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the fact that it was easy to get out and go to the loo, actually. Saw a few friends out at the bar.
I just realised where I know you from, Richard.
Oh, okay. We were trying to figure this out, weren't we?
From Summer Shakespeare 1996 at Fantasyland in Hastings.
No.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. My God. You, we were trying to work this out in the green room, weren't we? Yeah. You walked through the door, I went, I know you.
Wow. I was quite a lot smaller then. I was probably 17, I think.
Wow. I was 17 as well.
Yes, definitely. We were all 17 in the 90s.
The whole 90s, I was 17. Yeah. The whole time.
And most of the early 2000s.
Well, there you go, eh? There you go. Summer Shakespeare. Gosh. Well, we'll talk about that after the show, shall we? I was going to segue, and you just took my segue away, but that's all right. Talking about writing and keeping true to the story, Jekyll and Hyde, Pulp Fiction to Jekyll and Hyde. Have you moved a lot away from the story in order to make it work? I mean,
Definitely.
How many actors in the...
There's five actors in the piece. We play these kind of French... I guess you could maybe use the word clown, but that's not quite the right thing. Kind of role or mask is maybe a good way to think about it. And we kind of tell the story with the audience, and we go awry and get things wrong and recap and go, no, that didn't happen, and then tell different parts. And, the structure, I guess, is there and the key kind of moments, but a lot of it has been stripped away because the original text is so much about... kind of letters and quite inactive drama and mystery, and then that makes for quite a flaccid kind of theatrical experience.
A flaccid theatrical experience?
Yeah. The original's a novel.
Definitely. Mm. It doesn't have that trajectory like something like Don Juan had for us that was, just a kind of well-written play, quote-unquote. There's definitely key elements and key characters there, but it's... definitely not an homage to kind of gothic literature or anything like that.
Paul, you'll be able to answer this, so you're not allowed to. Who wrote it? Anyone else? Famous? Who wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Know.
You'll know when you hear it and you'll kick yourself.
No idea.
Okay,
it wasn't
Robin Louis Stevenson.
Yeah,
that's a clue.
Yes.
It was.
Yeah.
If anyone picks
him, you go. I've just been in Samoa, so, you know. I should know that, shouldn't I?
You guys know that Robert Louis Stevenson died in Samoa.
Mm. And is buried there.
His house is there, which you can tour, which is really amazing.
Yeah. Mm.
And we've talked to the owners. When I say we, I mean Selena Tusitala-Marsh and I have talked to the owners about possibly creating a writer's residency there.
That could somehow
be an exchange between... writers in Scotland, writers in New Zealand, and then Pacific writers coming here so we can keep them flowing around because it's an amazing place, isn't it?
Well, I have to confess, we never got there. On the final day, we were going to go and it absolutely bucketed with rain, and I was with my children and my father-in-law, so we were torn and the kids won out in the pool. we were staying at Stevenson's.
Oh, really?
Which... I think my father-in-law realised was related to Robert Louis Stevenson about day three. Farley's on the beach. It was fantastic. Anyway, enough about my holiday in Samoa. I talked about that last week. Jealous. But, Robert Louis Stevenson. And one of his more famous books, isn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely.
That and Treasure Island?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And so when you're talking about stripping away the story and you've talked about, you know, playing around with Pulp Fiction... how do you take your parents' story and keep it true without revealing all the dirty little secrets? I just made that up.
Yeah. I was like, what do you know?
I read the press release. Oh, no, I haven't. So how do you choose? I mean, there must be so much information that you...
Yeah, there is, but it was more focusing on, like, the themes of immigration and displacement and kind of... taking a story that I know very well, being my story, my parents' story, and kind of not so much focusing on, like, the actual events that happened as such, because a lot of creative license has been taken in that regard, but very much more so focusing on an immigrant's feelings and how it's kind of... when I was, like, originally writing it, I kind of wanted to... I don't, like... It's very strange to explain, and now I've just lost my train of thought. But no, what I was trying to say is that it's more focusing on, like, the feelings of what immigrants feel when they leave, like, the tiny human moments. Like, you see the news stories, and you see, you know, like, people obviously leaving their homeland and going somewhere new, but it's those feelings at, like, 1 a.m. when you're going, what the heck, I've just left everything, I've got no plans, I don't fit here, people don't think like me, people don't talk like me. And I saw that a lot in my parents when we moved. I was very young when we moved, but I was, like, you know, kind of witnessed them really struggling to kind of find the rhythm of New Zealand. Because when you come from a country that's got such a different rhythm, it's so hard to try and make yourself fit in. And even though I left when I was six and we immigrated here in 94, when I go back to South Africa, I immediately feel like I fit back into the rhythm of South Africa. Like, the energy that I emanate, the way that I speak, the way that I think, everybody is the same. And I feel like I've found my clan again. Or I found, like, yeah, my family. I just feel at ease. Whereas I saw my parents kind of have to struggle to, like, explain themselves or explain their humor or explain how they work, because every culture is so different. So that's more like what I focus on. Oh, good! I found my train of thought again.
Well, that was pretty good.
What a relief!
Yeah.
Robin, where did you move to? Where did your family move?
We moved to Hamilton. So we immigrated from a place.
Everyone's horrified.
Whoa, city of the future. Settle down.
It probably was in 1994.
Yeah. Never quite got there. It's still the city of the future. Yeah, we immigrated from a place called Somerset West, just outside of Cape Town. My father had a job at the Polytech in Hamilton, so that's where we immigrated to. And now they live in Tauranga. So
when my parents immigrated from South Africa, they moved to Featherston.
I didn't know you were South African.
Yeah, my family is. I was born here, but my brother and my parents are born and bred.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with my mother 2 days ago, who immigrated in the 70s from London to Napier. And touched on some of those things. She's struggling at the moment with retirement. She's asking herself a lot of questions. Does she want to retire in New Zealand? Or does she want to retire in the UK? She's really torn, because a full half of her life has been lived in each country.
And where does she feel?
And she has children in both country and grandchildren in both.
Has she given an indication of where she feels like home is?
We're trying to get her. We think she should move to Canada, so she's just in the middle.
Or Samoa.
So it's
warmer.
Or Samoa. Somewhere nice we can go on holiday.
Yeah, that's what you want. Yeah. Somewhere on the equator, you should say.
Yes.
Mum, on the equator.
Yeah.
I remember my grandfather, who he died at 97. He immigrated from Britain after the war with my dad. And he talked about, as far as immigration was concerned, he used to complain about immigrants. And I'd point out to him that he used to be one himself. Mm. He's like, I'm never an immigrant.
I'm an expat.
Oh, yeah. In it. Yeah. So, yeah, how do people see themselves, you know, as a first-generation New Zealander? Because you're not, are you?
I'm not.
No, you're not.
Yeah. And
so you still identify as a South African?
Absolutely. Like, I had this conversation last night. Somebody said, how long have you been here? And I said, about 24 years. And they went, you're Kiwi. And I went, no, like, I'm not. And even my friends still don't really believe that I am South African. But it's in, like, my father's, we've got, like, a really great lineage in South Africa. Like, my great-great-great-great-great-uncle, I think, he founded the Standard Bank in South Africa and was, like, a very prominent politician. And so, like, our family lineage has been, like, drilled into my brother and I that we don't forget that we are Pattersons and we don't forget where we come from. And it just... I don't know. It's something that's inexplicable, but I meet other South Africans around the world, and it just seems to be something about Africa. South Africans just don't ever seem to kind of leave it behind. And I met somebody at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last year, and they were South African, and they said, when you leave Africa, you just take a bit with you. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how we as a family very much feel, that, yeah, we still feel inside ourselves very South African. And patriotic to that.
There was an article in the New Zealand Herald today, Granny Herald, which was very interesting. I couldn't stop reading it. A woman called Emin Ng, who is Chinese, second generation, born here. Her parents were born here. Her grandparents immigrated here. And people still ask her, how long have you been here for?
Mm.
You know, she's facing that. And she's like, yeah?
Yeah.
But Robin, why did your parents come here?
They came because it was kind of Mandela was coming into power, and nobody was really sure how it was going to go down with the ANC, and just
I know, like, a family that's very close to my family, they left South Africa because they felt like they needed to buy a gun. And that's actually something that I've, like, incorporated and taken a bit of their story and put it into this play. And they always just, when they knew that when they had to have a gun in the house, it was time to go. So that's the reason they left. I think my brother and I were very small. I was 6. I think he was about 8. And when you've got small children and you kind of just don't know the political climate and you don't really know how it's going to go down, they just thought it was better to kind of take the family and go somewhere where we just didn't have to watch over our shoulders, you know, or grow up in an environment where you have to kind of think one step ahead of yourself. And this is something I found going back as an adult, is that in South Africa, I feel like you don't really live. You don't ever really get to be present or kind of enjoy life. You're living just kind of one step ahead of yourself. You just kind of, you know, looking over your shoulder, or you're just making sure the doors are locked, or you're just making sure that the security light's on, and why is that light on, and who's out there. It's just, you're constantly kind of in this state of being very, very aware. And when you're here in New Zealand, you just realize what a difference it is. You know, I left my keys in my car door 2 days ago, and I like came out, my keys were still there, and I was like, what? You know, like, it's just, it's those little differences, and that's kind of what I've incorporated into the play.
Have you found that?
Yeah, definitely. I've been back 3 times. I'm lucky enough to go back 3 times, and yeah, I distinctly remember we pulled up at a dairy to like get a drink, and someone put one of those, like, those things you put over your handlebars.
That's wheel lock.
They got out, put it on the wheel, locked the car, went in, got some milk, came out, unlocked the car, unlocked the thing. And I just remember, even at like 6 years old, being like, what are they doing that for? But yeah, for my parents, it was, yeah, they thought there was going to be a civil war, and they just felt deeply uncomfortable with the way that there was an expectation to treat people differently. They just felt weird about having servants. They felt horrible about, my dad was as a doctor, and he'd have different waiting rooms for people of colour, and they just knew it was wrong and were so uncomfortable with it, and didn't want my brother at the time, I didn't exist yet, but they didn't want him to grow up in a world where that was the done thing or the expected thing. And yeah, they just were, yeah, deeply, deeply uncomfortable with it, and yeah, were terrified of the violence as well. Like, my mum couldn't go anywhere by herself, and yeah, it was just...
See, I remember when I came over and I was 6, the first thing I noticed was that there were no bars on the windows in our house, and I remember being like, oh my goodness, like, where are the bars? This is crazy.
One funny cultural difference, my mum, the community were just phenomenal to my parents. My parents arrived and there was literally food in the fridge, toys for my brother, beds made up in the house. It was remarkable. But one funny thing, my mum was invited somewhere and the community were kind of being so supportive, and they were like, oh, I'll bring a plate. And so she kind of got her finest plate out of storage and like took this empty, her best plate, her empty plate. And then she saw that people had brought a plate of food and was like, oh, okay.
We have the exact same story.
Yeah. I think a lot of people come into New Zealand do, because bring a plate is such a Kiwi, it might be Australian as well. Language, cultural language is really particular different areas, isn't it? I mean, Paul, you know that with the poetry competition, and it's aimed at New Zealand poets, really, isn't it? And
National Poetry Day, yes. I mean, it's a celebration of poetry generally, but ideally we want people to think about reading and writing New Zealand poetry, and because it's the 20th anniversary this year, we've commissioned something called the 2020 Collection. We asked 20 established New Zealand poets, so people you would have heard of like Bill Manhire or like Selena Tusitala-Marsh, who I mentioned before, Vincent O'Sullivan, people who've been poet laureates and other people like that, to choose 20 of their own poems, one each. I don't want to get crazy. and then they would also choose a poem by someone who was young or up and coming, maybe less well known. So they didn't actually have to be a young poet. They might just be someone who had not published a lot or was not as well known as they might be. And so so then we have 20 of our known names, 20 of our new names. And we went for quite a wide geographical spread with it, and also ethnic spread. But what was quite heartening was in the second list, the list that people chose, the ethnic spread was much, much more evident. And so you had situations where, say, Kevin Ireland, who was really very well-known, very established Pākehā poet, you know, very much of the Sons of Sargeson generation, you know, really sort of mainstream Pākehā poetry in many people's minds. But the poet he chose as his pick was Gregory Kahn, who is a New Zealand poet of Chinese descent and doing quite interesting things around his Asian heritage, quite interesting writing. And it was very heartening to see how our next wave of writers is much more reflective of the country as a whole and its many different voices and styles and approaches and heritages.
It's important that all the voices are heard, I suppose, through theatre, through film, through poetry.
And yeah, there's a big problem, as we all know, that there's a major skills gap in the country, mainly for Māori and Pacifica youth, who are not operating on an even playing field. Mm-hmm. And many of our students who go to Decile 1 schools are not getting the advantages to do with reading and writing. So, therefore, they're not going to be turning up at a publisher anytime soon with a finished manuscript.
And I suppose even that whole passageway into publishing in, for Māori and Pacifica is quite difficult from the different cultural ways of approaching and pushing yourself forward and those sorts of things. It makes it very difficult, those pathways.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk endlessly about this in the literary sector, about trying to address that skills gap and to do more mentoring and more working with up-and-coming writers so that they do get to the point where they can submit a manuscript or just be even considerate, as you say.
I'm a big fan of Te Reo Māori being compulsory in New Zealand schools. And actually today, this is great because what you've just said leads into, I'm not a fan of thrash metal, I'm just going to say, okay? I am not a fan of thrash metal, believe it or not.
I know where you're going with this.
You know where I'm going with this? A week ago, a song was released, Ruana Te Whenua by Alien Weaponry, who are a young band out of, I want to say Tauranga, but it's not, is it? I'll find out. But they are young, 15, 17 and 16 years old, and they have been given a lot of grief, actually, because they're, to quote from the press release, pasty white guys, they've been called, and they actually have Māori heritage, and they have released this song, this thrash metal song, in Te Reo Māori. And it's pretty, I'm not into thrash metal, I say, but listening to thrash in Te Reo is cool because it's, you know, it's our language of Aotearoa. And as you see, you know, the language, giving them the opportunity, them being bold enough to go, you know what, I'm going to do this in Te Reo, and it's thrash metal, and it's not our market, but, you know, have a listen to this. So I'm going to play a little bit of thrash metal, Te Reo, Alien Weaponry. And I admire these young men because they are going to be at the cutting edge of introducing Te Reo Māori to an audience that probably has no idea about it. And it's actually really good music. There's a lot of arguments on social media about why they're doing it in Te Reo Māori, and they actually said they want to have a point of difference because it's a hard area. That's their heritage. Why not? So here we are. Alien Weaponry, Ruana Te Whenua. Ruana Te Whenua. Apologies.
Whakarongo mai rā! Whakarongo mai rā! Whakarongo mai rā! Whakarongo mai rā! Whakarongo mai ki te tangi o ngā pūrunga i te taumata a mokahinaina!
Cut the door,
Wow. It's all over the media, isn't it, at the moment, including us.
We love
it. It's so good. It just, you know, I'm not a fan of thrash metal. I couldn't listen to that. You know, I'm in my living room for too long. But 10 old pie, guys. Well done for taking really good music, thrash, good production.
Yeah.
And Te Reo Māori, because that, you know, going back to that idea that language has to be, you know, the identity of Māori, Pacifica, I don't want to lump them together, but, you know, different people, their different cultures being supported, and particularly Te Reo Māori in New Zealand. And Aporana Taylor has a poem called The Haka, because I said that the opening of that song sounded very much like The Haka, you know, and it worked with the thrash, man. It was raw, raw. That sounded good. That's my best bra.
So, Richard, if you're going to read this Uppy Taylor poem out, you've got to give it your all.
Well, no, I was going to get one of the actors to do it, actually. Okay, so well, I want to see who's going to volunteer.
I volunteer.
Susie. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's...
beautiful voices.
Thanks, guys.
Do you want to come up here?
It's got a lot of oomph, though. It's up there, though.
It's up there.
Oh, it's up here.
Now, I should just say that this is one of the 2020 collection. It's up on the National Poetry Day website, so it's one of the 20 key poems that...
Have a quick look.
...we think all New Zealanders should be reading.
No pressure, Susie.
Yeah.
Cool. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to pass you the Richard mic, which is quite special. She just dropped the Richard mic.
Just destroyed the sacred mic.
You do the mic drop afterwards.
Yeah, sorry guys. I need to get my Beyonce on. When I hear the haka and I feel it in my bones and in my wairua, the call of my tipuna flashes like lightning up and down my spine. It makes my eyes roll and my tongue flick. It is the dance of earth and sky, the rising sun and the earth shaking. It is the first breath of life. E-ah-ha-ha.
E-ah-ha. So how long have you been organising the National Poetry Day?
I don't just feel like I organise it so much as just I'm, you know, implicated in it heavily. I've been back in New Zealand for 2 years, and so I've been involved with the Book Awards Trust for the last 18 months or so.
Yep.
So, and yeah, we do the National Book Awards, the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards, the Children and Young Adults Book Awards, and then we do National Poetry Day as well. And this year we just wanted to really encourage people to read and buy and borrow New Zealand books. All of these poems that are in the 2020 collection you can find in a library near you, in an anthology or in a collection. Just really encourage people to read New Zealand books, because there's so wide a range of work that's being produced now by such a wide range of voices that people should, you know, read it and not just read the usual suspects.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of New Zealand work involved in Short and Sweet?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Short and Sweet is one of the leading festivals when it comes to new New Zealand work, especially in dance and in theatre. And as an artistic creator, I kind of actively also seek out communities, writers and makers from various different kind of diverse communities and people that are not often seen in our main stages to present work. And I think often we have organisations that the doors are just too guarded for them to come through. So it's about us actively going out there and seeking work. So we've got a massive a representation of stories from all over New Zealand, but also specifically Auckland as well. I'm really interested in the kind of diversity that exists in here. So across just not just the voices, but also in style and genres as well. Yeah.
And Ahi, Short and Sweet, am I right in thinking that it's a really great launching pad for a lot of artists? Because it's the pressure of creating a full-length piece is taken away.
Absolutely.
And you're within a supported festival environment. So, because I know that some of the works that have been created for Short and Sweet have then gone on to have either spurred new works or have gone on to be developed to become fuller length works. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So, I mean, for us with Short and Sweet, what we want to do is give them as much as the admin and the kind of producing kind of support. So the artist just focuses on making the art. Mm-hmm. So they come and we provide the technician, we provide the stage manager or the marketing collateral. And so basically the writer or the director just has to make stuff in there. Yeah,
that, sorry, yeah, I didn't want to interrupt you, but that's how my show started.
Oh,
the
wow.
South Africans, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I originally did a 10-minute version of this version that I'm doing now back in 2012 for Short and Sweet Theatre,
cool,
and won Best Independent Theatre Company for it.
And now it's and been now it's Edinburgh.
It's been to Edinburgh.
And come back home again.
Yeah. I'm actually lucky enough to have seen it in Edinburgh.
Oh, did you come?
Yes, with a South African who now lives in Auckland.
Did we meet?
Yep.
Because I know everybody.
Oh, you did? Oh, we met at that brunch.
Yes, and
I totally forgot.
I know, out of context, right? And because last time I saw you was on stage, and this, and I was there. Well, I wanted to say actually when you were talking about your parents and you were talking about the creation of the story. Mm. One of the things that that still resonates with me is the moisturizer that you're. This beautiful characterization. Because it's one actor on stage, but it feels like a stage full of people, and the finding those elements of personalities and then weaving them into these bigger stories is a really beautiful piece of storytelling. But also, I think testament to the craft of being able to deliver them simultaneously. It felt like
Thank you. It's really great.
I definitely recommend seeing it.
Thank you very much. I felt like I could do exactly what you're talking about.
I'd love to hear from an artist's perspective what the experience was for you.
Oh, exactly what you're talking about. The not having the stress of producing and marketing and trying to get people to come and see it. Playing to a man and a woman who are both in their 60s is so challenging within itself. But that it was the perfect environment that I was like, look, it's only 10 minutes. I'm just going to give it a go. And you would have seen, I mean, the show, the very first scene is the 10-minute version that I did. And then I just built on from that and turned it into a 65-minute show. But, yeah, it was the absolute perfect environment in order to try something new and try something creative and different.
Yeah, and when I think of other, white face crew who've kind of gone on big. They started for Short and Sweet as well, and they're going to Edinburgh as well this year. Mm. Proud the Asian Theatre. They won a couple of years, and now they've got their own company, and they did this show Call of the Sparrows last year. There's a whole heap of people across, because we do theatre and dance. But what I really like about the festival is that they're 10-minute plays, and in one night you can see up to about 10 to 12 different shows, so you get audiences seeing works that they wouldn't normally otherwise see. Mm. So they're coming to support their whānau. So, last year we had a massive South Asian contingency coming in to see works that they would never come and see because their friends are not in it. And as a result of that, now they come to the venue to see other shows. So for me, as a maker, it's lovely to know that we're growing our audiences as well. Because we need that for sustainability for the future.
But from an audience perspective as well, if it's not your cup of tea, it's only 10 minutes long.
10 minutes.
you're not over-committed.
Yeah. Yum Chow Theatre, move along.
Yum Chow Theatre, I like that.
Yum Chow Theatre.
Yeah.
Gosh, Kick-Arts, the home of reunions. Ellen, you just need to stop talking, mate. You're taking up too much of the show.
Ellen's first radio interview.
And I'm really interested about how film fits in to Shorten Street, because you've got stuff that's already made. So is there a time limit? Like if you had to have had it made in the last 2 years?
Because it's our first festival, we're not that strict on, obviously the time limit aspect. Sean Sweet celebrates performance arts, and obviously that leads quite naturally into moving image and film. Going forth, we'd love to see, if you're interested in adapting some theatre works into film, the 10-minute format could be a good way to sort of get that started. And also another benefit is Sean Sweet being a... coming from a background of a family of films around the world, it's held over the world, so we're launching the film festival aspect together, and what that means is not only are you able to sort of show your film to the local audience, but you're legible to all the film festivals around the world for Short and Sweet. Mm-hmm. And what we've done really amazingly is in the LA, all of this is leading up to, every year will lead up to a sort of grand gala in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard. And that's with a partnership with a really amazing studio and school called Stella Adler. So that's founded by someone who's sort of the technique is being taught to guys like Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro.
I trained there as well.
Yeah,
that's my secondment when I was in training.
Awesome,
Stella Adler in LA.
Nice. Yeah. So if you enter your film to Short and Sweet, our judges' choice and the People's Award will go to be screened at Stella Adler next year.
Amazing.
And it's still judged by the panel with Mark Ruffalo and all these guys who are alumni.
Do you all feel that the way the world has shrunk, that makes it a lot easier for New Zealand artists who at some stage were at the bottom of the top of the world, and then all this access to things like Short and Sweet and to going to Edinburgh and stuff, it's become a lot. I mean, to travel to Edinburgh 20 years ago would just been Yeah, unimaginable.
Still pretty tricky,
isn't it? Have you got to get a little page or whatever? Is that what it's called?
Give a little.
Not this time.
We feel because part of that for us is with crowdfunding. It's so often it's actually your friends and family, and we don't want to crowdfund for something that we're not delivering to them.
Right.
So it's really we're trying to figure that one out a little bit at the moment. Also, we've done it a couple of times, but it is. I think that absolutely. The globalisation of the world through online media has definitely made it more possible. We can Skype our venue in Edinburgh. We don't have to physically be there. We don't have to go and live in the UK for 2 years in order to put on a show that we're actually able to do and most of the work. And I've stayed home. The first time Puppet Fiction went to Edinburgh was in 2015. And I stayed home because I had a small child. So I stayed home and sort of ended the Facebook marketing from my living room in Kilbirnie in Wellington. Well, these guys were over having lots of fun without me. Not bitter at all.
It was all fun.
It's still very, very hard work.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, I'm...
Because parenting's not, of course.
No.
No. That was
so
easy.
Yeah. Great production to date.
Oh, nice.
I work, my day job is as the director of the New Zealand Fringe Festival in Wellington.
Okay.
And one of the things that we've been working really, really hard on is an artist development stream where we connect and network with festivals all over the world so that we can help artists get out of New Zealand and also meet people over there, experience works elsewhere in the world, and then bring that knowledge and that artistry back. This really beautiful kind of cross-pollination for artists happening. And that's something we've really seen. I know when we started the show in 2012, we were like, oh, our dream would be to go to Edinburgh, thinking it was kind of a pie in the sky. And then a year later, we were in Adelaide. And a year later, then we did Perth the year after that, where we were seen by the venue manager who has booked us for Edinburgh 3 years in a row. And this year, he's put us in his biggest room. So we're going to be doing a live stream of the show while it's being performed.
Yeah, yeah. For those people in the back row.
Yeah, it's kind of about finding those pathways. And I love Edinburgh for all the Kiwis in Edinburgh. It's like a Kiwis in Edinburgh Facebook page, and they all get together, and you can find them at the Pear Tree. So anyone travelling to Edinburgh who just feels like hearing some Kiwi accents, just going to hang out at the Pear Tree pub, and they'll be around.
Don't you go overseas to experience different cultural ideas?
Yeah, but you check in. You know,
when you get homesick, it's
interesting about the short and sweet thing with the 10 minutes as well. John, when we originally, very, very first time we ever did the show, you were there.
Yeah, I was there.
It was 15 minutes long.
At the pit bar.
Yeah, it was 15 minutes long.
That was part of our marketing strategy. We did it in the smallest venue we could find. It had a maximum capacity of 14 or 15. So we figured if 10 people turn up, we could say we had a sold-out season.
It went really well, though. We had one show. We had, 28 people, and someone in the back passed out.
Yeah,
go too hot.
Kind of a
that was when we. That was when we discovered the capacity of the pit bar.
Yeah, it was bigger than we thought it was.
How do you all... a lot of these projects you're talking about have been going on for a while. I mean, Short and Sweet's Short and Sweet.
This is our seventh year now?
Seventh year. Yes. Yep. And you've been doing this since 2012. Yeah. The Poetry Day has been the Phantom Bill sticker, Poetry Day, National Poetry Day.
20 years.
Yeah. You've been...
Slightly Isolated Dog's been making these kind of works for since 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But before and that, though, Leo Jean Peters had this idea to do Don Juan, because I remember talking to him years ago and workshopping this idea about creating this mad idea about creating a party, basically, like a piece of theatre that was like a party for the audience. And it was just so wonderful seeing it come to life. It's such a vibrant piece of work.
Oh, wow.
You really come out of there, like, celebratory.
Nice.
It's really, it allows you to be naughty as an audience. It's really charming. Because I just saw it last week. I just had such a ball. I've been, like, telling all my mates to go see it. It's just guilt-free, pleasurable fun. And you get to be a little bit dark for a little moment, too. That's really cool.
Yeah, totally. Yes.
And with your... I've got a line, a thread going. You know, it's great.
I keep...
I was actually thinking...
It's fine. About, guys. I've talked enough.
About 5 minutes ago, I was going to go, I just might go and make myself a cup of coffee and come back. You guys were chatting quite nicely.
Yeah, we got this.
You've got a lot of... I know. Ahi. Well done. Awesome. I told you. Just chat like you're in the living room. And you've developed since Short and Sweet in 2012, which is 5 years ago. My question being, how do you all sustain that through line in the same project or the same idea or the same, how does the same concept sustain and keep it interesting for audiences, keep them engaged, keep them wanting to come back?
Well, I think it's really important that it doesn't stay the same. Yeah. I think it's important that it's different every time and it grows. I know for us, like, it's so rare for artists to have time to develop work. It's such a luxury and such a gift. Even if, like, coming back to do Jekyll and Hyde at the basement this time around, we only had 5 days to rework it up, but it's still time to change and develop. And yeah, so I think it's less about holding on to something and more about how it grows and how it develops personally.
John, this has been a real love.
I mean,
passion project.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't really come into performance as a performer. I just had the stupid idea with puppets and in a movie that everyone loves, hopefully. But for me, it's that passion. You've got to hold on to that passion, and that'll drive you through. But also that changing, and every time we perform this show, there is elements that we can't account for. And,
it's really evolved a lot since we first created it. So everywhere we go, we localise it to wherever we are. So if you've seen the show somewhere else, what you see in Auckland, what you see at the basement, will be specific to that venue and quite often to the audience. And we're so lucky because we have James Nikise in our cast, who is he's so switched on and tuned in, and he knows he has pulled really interesting aspects and themes out of Pulp Fiction, and then he lays them out for the audience. Mm. So there is this really biting commentary on the racism of Tarantino's work, and he doesn't do it in a way that undermines the work. It sort of it highlights it, and it really makes our audience think about some other things. They're having a great time and they're laughing in the way they are with most of the works that we're talking about here, and engaging with them. But in the same way that with poetry, you read something, and the first time you read it, you get something, and the second time, and then when you think back on it, there are different takeaways from it. Mm. And I think evolving the work, and even as an audience member, in the same way that you, if you watch Pulp Fiction now, you will have a very different experience to when you watched it when it came out in 1994. Yeah.
I tried to watch it.
And it can be really difficult at times. So it's... And that's so in the same way that a written word doesn't go away, live performance doesn't either. Mm-hmm. And revisiting it can sometimes just bring out a whole other world.
Mm-hmm. I watched it with my son because I said, "Gotta watch this film, part of my youth. It's fantastic." Started watching, I went, "Okay." Yeah. And my son went, "It's quite slow, Dad."
And that's something that worries us. The first time we ever did it.
You come see the puppet show, it's a lot more exhilarating.
It's a lot more action.
I was waiting for that dance scene, you know, and the restaurant, and it just never came. And then, and then we watched that and he went, "Is that what you wanted me to see?"
Oh, you should see our dance scene. You should see puppets attempting.
Well, I think I think we're going to get a chance to do shameless promotion soon of your shows, and you can and your events, and you can talk about when they're. But yours is a whole that's going on at the moment, isn't it?
Will you just talk about Edinburgh a little bit more? Because I'm really envious of hearing everyone talk about Edinburgh. I've been to the Edinburgh Festival many times because I used to live in the UK. Loved going, and I love that you could go to something where there were a dozen people in a bar, most of whom seem to be there by mistake, you know, and you go and see something that might be funny or it might be really engrossing or it might not. That opportunity's not there for writers of books. It's not there. There's the Edinburgh Book Festival, but you have to be invited to that. Which New Zealand authors get invited? Hardly any.
So why is that?
Because much as we all love the internet, and in fact that's why we have the 2020 collection online, so people can access it, whether they're here or overseas, if they're a teacher in a school, whoever they are, they can access it. But the printed book, our publishing industry in the English language is still controlled by London and New York. Right. The vast majority of New Zealand books, almost all of these poetry books, do not get published anywhere but New Zealand. Our bookshops are full of things that come down to us from the Northern Hemisphere, but our books don't go back up there.
No.
Something gets published in London, it'll be published in South Africa, it'll be published in Australia, it'll be published in New Zealand, it'll be published in Canada, because it's the old empire at work. But it does not flow the other way. And in fact, Catherine Chidgey, who won our Ockham New Zealand Book Awards this year with her novel The Wish Child, she won the $50,000 Acorn Foundation Fiction Prize. Mm. It's been incredibly well reviewed and received, that novel. Edinburgh Book Festival were not interested in it.
That would have to be one of the best books. I could not put that book down.
She would be delighted to hear it, but she is not one of the three New Zealand authors going on a special deal to go to Edinburgh.
Who are the authors?
It's Hera Lindsay Bird, the poet, Courtney Cena Meredith, who's an Auckland-based poet and performance poet and also short story writer, and Sarah Lang, who wrote a graphic novel called Mansfield and Me about her life and Catherine Mansfield's life. So Edinburgh's interested in the kind of more fringy things. In fact, I think they're going to try and put them into the Fringe Festival in some way. But their standard book festival rather, you won't see any New Zealand writers there from year to year, except maybe Witi Ihumaira, because if you get a movie made of your work, then you tend to be better well-known overseas. But it's still a huge issue for New Zealand writers, and it's a huge issue because lots of New Zealand readers simply aren't reading our books either. There's still, unfortunately, around our literature, still a cultural cringe that I don't think exists in the same way in other art forms.
I love New Zealand books. In fact, I was surprised The Wish Child was a New Zealand book. I didn't know it was a New Zealand author. My wife read it. She said, "You've got to read this book." I picked it up. I read it. I went, "Oh, my God." And then I went, "This is a New Zealand author." What a fantastic... Anyone else read it?
No, I just wrote it down.
It's gripping. And moving, and I can't even... There's not enough words
to... World War II, Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah, really fantastic.
It's not even based in New Zealand, and it's...
lots of our books aren't. You know, because what makes it New Zealand literature is that a New Zealander is doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the uptake like for New Zealand literature in New Zealand, though? Because I know the book festival that is part of the New Zealand festival, everything seems to sell out. It seems to be very popular. Is there much of an uptake within New Zealand for it here?
No, basically. So you're talking about the Wellington Festival.
Yes,
I'd love the way in Wellington they call it an international festival. It's international in Wellington, because that means they get all the money. No offence, this isn't Auckland this weekend. We just call ours here in Auckland the Auckland Writers Festival. It's huge here. The Auckland Writers Festival, it's, 72,000 people this year attending the Auckland Writers Festival. And, of course, a lot of events with New Zealand writers are really well attended. But it was quite telling to me that we always have an event on the Wednesday. I work for the University of Auckland, and we have this thing called the University of Auckland Lecture. Last year we had Steve Brawnius talking about his true crime book. Filled a lecture theatre of 300, no problem for that. Mm. It was really, really great. This year we had Tina Makareti come up, very influential and important Māori writer, to give a lecture on... What is the deal with New Zealand publishing? Only 3% of the books published in this country are by Māori Pacific authors. Mm. So what she was asking, what kind of house of literature do we want? Mm. What do we want? What are we building? And it was held in the Spiegel tent in Altair Square, which I thought mean we would get more people, because we were right in the centre of things. And we got an audience, but I would say it was probably a third of what Steve got last year. And that's the answer, isn't it? That's the kind of house of literature we want. That big festival audience, 72,000 people, only a really small handful were interested in discussing sort of one of the big issues confronting us in contemporary New Zealand literature. So it disappoints me a bit. And Selena and I then went on to our website, the Academy of New Zealand Literature, and said, why aren't you reading Brown? And then we recommended 21 books by Māori Pacifica writers that we think people should be reading now. And it's got massive attention. It got 7,000 hits, I think, in June. Lots and lots of people interested in it, but really trying to encourage people to help create the kind of culture we want in our country. We want a really vibrant arts culture. Mm. We were all really engaged with our own stories and also just the imaginations and the creativity of our art makers here. And that means not just looking at overseas work.
Mm. Yeah, we need to look inward a little bit. I think that's with our stories, our books. I read a book by Anne Galmuzina, Glamuzina, I think
you're supposed to pronounce it these days.
Rich Man Road, which I thought was a really good story. Another book I really enjoyed. I knew it was a New Zealand one because it's rich. It's, you know, Richmond Road. But a really cute story. Cute's probably the wrong word. Really, it covered some really interesting-ish dawn raids, you know, our history. And I think we write some really good stories. We really do. And how do we get them out there? Short and Sweet does it, do you? Do you think there's enough New Zealand material in there?
I mean, I actively program like 80% of the program with New Zealand work because I think it's really important for our writers and our
friends. Would there be a thought to have a New Zealand section for Short and Sweet, or would that make it kind of silo the work?
I think it does, and I've debated that with the team over the years. I mean, each year I was like looking for a point of difference. Mm. Like last year, I really actively pushed for female directors because we just needed more of that in the industry. And the year before that, I was looking for stories by new migrants because there were so many of them working within fringes of often all this kind of community. Practices are kept to the Mangere Arts Centre and stuff. No, we need to be visible. Those stories need to be seen on main stage to bring them to the city. But I think each year, the New Zealand stories, I think people are getting more confident in being able to articulate stories about everyday New Zealanders, because often I still find that with the play, with the 10-minute short form playwriting format, we're still emulating kind of Hollywood sitcoms or that kind of writing about characters that are so far away from who we are. And I guess, you know, the question is for the writer whether they're wanting to develop their writing craft, in which case it doesn't matter who they're writing about because, you know, everyone's got a different objective. Mm. But for me, as an artistic curator, for me, it's about let's get the New Zealand experience, the New Zealand story up on main stage more often.
Just a question about South Africa. I don't know if you've worked over there, but all South African theatre and arts and books, how supported is it there? Is there a lot of Indigenous work, or is there a lot of South African theatre? I know the Youth Theatre Conference actually was in Cape Town this year, a massive big youth theatre.
Yeah, I know they've got a lot of fringe festivals. I know they're very supportive of the arts and like and theatre, but that's something that I'm really not familiar with. Like, I'm not entirely sure. I know that, you know, in the future, my team and I, we'd like to go to the Grahamstown Arts Festival. Mm. We'd really like to take the show there. And, you know, like the Cape Town, like, I mean, that's just such a vibrant theatre scene down there. I would love to take the show there. But, yeah, in terms of, like, what you're saying, like, I don't know about you, but, no, I'm really not familiar with it.
The good news is that I've now got contact with a South African festival director in Durban, and he has invited Catherine Chidji, who we've been talking about, and Kellyanna Murray, one of our Māori novelists, who wrote a really fantastic book called Daylight Second about Farlap, the racehorse, who we are all too young to remember personally.
Far what? far away.
But he's, through the Academy of New Zealand Literature, we've been really trying to promote New Zealand writers directly to festivals, really similar to your list idea, Hannah. But it's often a lot more complicated because our books aren't published in those markets. But this guy in Durban, you know, incredibly interested in New Zealand writing because we need to start making those connections ourselves, particularly across the Southern Hemisphere, and not wait for publishers with their old imperial networks to grind into gear. You have to make things happen.
I'm a big fan of that, of what you're saying, like making things happen and finding a way, like being here in New Zealand and, you know, like we are so isolated and we are so at the bottom of the world. If you actually top of the world, yeah. Depends which way you're looking at it.
Top.
If you don't put yourself out there, if you don't make those connections for your theatre company, for you as an independent artist, for whatever festival you're running, if you actually don't put in the hard yards and be not aggressive but assertive in showing that you can actually do this and showing that you've got work that is as good as anywhere else, you're actually just not going to get seen or get out or put your work out there. You have to. I'm just such a big fan of what you said about making your own opportunities, and I think if the opportunities aren't there, then go beat a path, make your own path.
I was incredibly lucky. I just got back from San Diego last week, where I was at the San Diego International Fringe Festival. And we have created a cultural exchange with them, and we had a New Zealand show called Allergic to Love by Tom Knowles.
Yes.
And he took that to San Diego, and as part of that, they curated him to also play in Mexico. Oh, wow. So, and on the way, they stopped off in Fiji on the way, and they played a gig there as well. So they were like, we've just been to 300. but what we find is that the more we can help they did so well. Everybody absolutely loved them. It's a rock opera. And what we find, though, is that if we can just get one show over there and we support them as well as we can to have a really great run, then it immediately makes people interested in other things from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where all genres and aspects of the arts can support itself.
And I want to say on that as well, Sam Wills, the boy with tape on his face, or
yes.
tape face,
yeah. mm-hmm.
I bumped into him at Edinburgh last year. And just even him doing what he's doing, he's got residency in Vegas now. So mm. he's playing Vegas and he's playing all over America. And he's in London. It's incredible. And to find out, you know, that he's Kiwi and New Zealand.
Trigby Wakenshaw.
Trigby's yeah. amazing. Yeah. Actually,
there's an example of some... I mean, in London, the top 10 picks for the festival, he's in the top 10 for the... I think the Daily Telegraph picked.
Yeah.
With his show with his son, Phineas.
Yes.
Yeah, me and my...
We're in the top picks for the Free Festival. Just
nice. Which Free Festival is that called?
In the Edinburgh Free Fringe oh, Festival.
So it's the Edinburgh Reporter's Pick of the Fringe.
Hey, there you go, exactly. And now those eyes are actually...
I sit amongst royalty.
We were the top of the pick in 2015.
There we go.
But we'll make it this year.
Okay. Jekyll and Hyde next. And then it's a whole list of Kiwi novelists and writers.
Well, I won $22 on Lotto a couple of weeks ago, so there you go.
You mentioned Sam Wicks. I don't know if anybody else here has seen it, but there is a really brilliant you'll find it under the world on the World Fringe Facebook page. There's a link to a talk that Sam gave about creating opportunities, mm-hmm. about how to be an artist in the world. And he's, you know, this kid from the South Island who used to do lots of talking, and then now he's six tape on his face. But it's a really, from an artist's perspective, and I don't think it matters what aspect of art you're interested in, it's a really fascinating talk. I think it's like 40 minutes long, but it is just put it on and do the dishes and listen to him. Mm-hmm. It is so interesting.
So this kid from the Hawke's Bay, who seemed quite quiet at the time, I didn't probably know you very well, actually. Quite at the time, is now doing what you're doing. So how do you go from Napier or Hastings or the Hawke's Bay? Where were you based, in Hastings?
No, I was in Napier.
Napier. So what drove you to start and to keep doing what you're doing?
Without giving away my age too much, at the time...
You already said you were 17 in 1993. Okay.
Toi Fakati didn't accept... students until they were 20 at that stage. And I had auditioned for and gotten into other drama programs in New Zealand. So when I left school, my plan was to do that. But I really, really wanted to go to Toi Fakati, to the New Zealand Drama School, and had a long conversation with an advisor from there. And I decided that I would go and get life experience instead of waiting out and doing 2 years at a different course. So I took my whole life savings of $1,500, which is not enough to live on in London for a week. And I went to London when I was 18.
Wow.
And I ended up working in a bookshop, in Foyle's bookshop in Charing Cross Road. I worked there for nearly 2 years before coming back. I fell in love. I totally fell off the acting wagon. And then I started studying part-time. And I was doing an English literature degree. And actually my passion was reignited through reading plays. And so I threw in the towel on my advertising career, which I had driven a path into at that stage, and came back to New Zealand, went to Victoria University, I met Ahe Lan out in the quad, yeah. out in the amphitheatre, and that's also where I met John Coddington. Mm-hmm. John was studying production design at Toi Fakati at the time, and I finished my degree there, and whenever I needed anything made in a show, I'd phone John. Didn't matter what it was. I still do.
Obviously.
Struggling artist will pick up any work.
So, John, is your creativity from a performance point of view or from a making things point of view?
Totally from a making point of view, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
How'd you get into that? I mean, high school, did you make stuff?
Not really. Actually, I mean, I've been drawing all my life. But then it was... going to uni, I did the first year in illustration. I thought that's where I'd go, and then found the performance design degree in the last end of the first year, which is all pretty broad. You study different disciplines. There was the theatre project, and you went to split into groups, and you could either do the graphics, the costumes for fashion, or the set design for performance design. everyone went did graphics, and I was like, oh, stuff that, I'm going to do the set design. And just loved it, and yeah, changed my major, did the next 3 years at Toi Whakaari, and then found the joys of Fringe. yeah, all those Fringe benefits.
As a, as a designer, mm-hmm. does it pay better than being an actor?
No, ooh, probably not. No, 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 but I've always done... a lot of my work has just been my own stuff. It's just the, I have this thing to get out, and Pulp Fiction being one of them. I wanted to make puppets, and I thought that Pulp Fiction, my favourite movie, was a great vehicle for that, and I thought, yeah...
You should see that. You should see that. I'm staying with John while I'm in Auckland this week, and he he's kicked out onto the sofa, and he's working on some masks at the moment, which is so totally different to any of the craft involved in puppet fiction, but still obviously very much about creating character, and there are four, who are they for? They're a commission for somebody.
Yeah, they're for Whitsuntide in
Wellington.
Wellington, yeah.
Okay.
So they just commissioned 12 masks that I've been really behind on, but they'll be coming very shortly.
Did you get that for today? They came.
I'm so sorry.
So,
for
that's for the students to...
Yeah, they're for the training and mask, and so there'll be four neutral masks and eight basal masks, which, yeah, it's quite fascinating to... As I'm making, you know, it's neutral mask aside, with basal, it's sort of finding those emotions within the mask that aren't necessarily one emotion. You can, you know, apply them in different ways, and... it's fascinating stuff. I love mask work. Yeah, I'd love to do more in that field.
Have you seen Solo Fellow?
No.
Or with a mask, using Marty
Regan
mask.
Regan Taylor's
piece. Oh. Yeah.
Last year at the Auckland Writers' Festival in the schools days, the guy from Indian Ink came along.
Jacob Rogers.
Yeah, and he showed the students what you could do with masks and how you could transform a personality. Yeah. They were all completely absorbed in it.
And going back to you and your comments around publishing, you've obviously been involved with publishing for a while.
Well, I've been writing books for a while. I suppose...
Your background, how did you get into this industry, into publishing, writing?
Well, I'm in the literary sector. That's where you talk about the sector. Do you guys talk about that in drama? Do you talk about the sector?
Is it the industry?
The industry. Yeah. Like it's really busy and there's smokestacks.
We call it an industry, so we just call it a sector.
Mine's more of a shed.
It sounds like a zone to which we've been, you know,
allocated.
Yes, and there are guards around it or something.
There's barbed wire around it.
You locked into the arts precinct.
I've been publishing books of my own. I mean, I have been published since 2002, I guess. But it's since I came back to New Zealand after being away for 30 years. I think I am the oldest person here. Being away a long time and coming back and feeling as though when you're in your own country, you have to kind of do something. You can't just sit around and be a bystander. So that's why I got involved in the Book Awards Trust. That's why I'm very involved in the Auckland Writers Festival, particularly its schools program. I do all sorts of mentoring through schools programs. This year through the Auckland Diversity Fund, doing a lot with three schools in South Auckland. We did a performance at the festival called 1001 Nights in Auckland, where school kids rewrote Ali Baba.
Oh, right.
It was really, really funny. It was great. Basement let us rehearse there. People said, oh, you must have been rehearsing for a long time. I'm like, since 1 o'clock today, we had about 2 hours. But it was really, really great. And so I suppose I had my finger in many pies within the literary sector. But then last year I got some money out of the university to fund the Academy of New Zealand Literature, because it really is about what we've been talking about, about mid-career and senior writers being proactive to try and find new audiences and new opportunities, whether it's at a festival overseas or at a residency or just through communicating, just through, you know, writing an essay and getting it up onto our website. We also have a conversation corridor between a New Zealand writer and an overseas writer every month, just to try and open some windows. It's very important, and we can't just sit around sulking and waiting for Creative New Zealand to give us money.
No.
Because we'll all grow very old.
And I suppose
old.
That's what you're all talking about. From, it doesn't matter what sector you're in. You were saying earlier, you know, you've just got to get on and do it. And if you wait, I suppose that's what I hear quite a lot on the show. People, whether it's dance, even fashion, anything, if you wait for people to... The old days of waiting by the phone for someone to call, you or your publisher or your agent or something, it just won't happen, will it?
You just can't do it. Like when I went to Edinburgh last year, I did a crowdfunder campaign and, you know, got a bit of money through there. But I've self-funded it because I was like, I'm just not... I mean, I put in an application for funding and got denied. And I live by that mentality. And my acting teacher, Mike Sosente, used to say it all the time, and I just adopted it, which was find reasons to act, not reasons not to act. Mm. There are so many reasons not to do something. You can always find reasons not to write the show, not to put on the show. Oh, that people aren't going to come. Oh, I don't have the money. There are always ways around it. I'm such like an advocate, especially here in New Zealand. There are opportunities, and you have to take the opportunities. And if there aren't any opportunities, you're still living in a country where... you're so lucky to be able to make these opportunities. Like, I just got back from living in the UK 2 weeks ago. So I've been there for 3 years. And in London, you would know, Hannah, there are just so many opportunities. Mm. Yeah. There's so many doors and that you could just go through. There are so many applications. There are so many festivals. There are so many awards. There are so many everything that you can go for. Mm. Here, if there isn't any, you shouldn't let that stop you. If there isn't, like you say, you created the, was it Academy? You shouldn't let the fact that something doesn't exist here stop you from following or doing what you want to do. I'm just so, I don't like that. I don't like excuses. I just think, like, if there isn't a path, make a path. There are so many obstacles. There are ways to get around the obstacles. Sorry, I get very passionate about it.
It's hard, though.
I feel myself going on a rant.
It is hard, though, for people in the arts industry, isn't it? Is it not? Because actually people do get knocked back a lot, and you have to have a certain resilience to actually stand up and say, this is not going to hold me back. I'm going to get up again and go again. But people have to give themselves space. Do you have to, how do you cope with that?
I feel like, it's any industry that you get knocked back. It's just harder being an artist in the industry because it's really personal.
Yeah.
And everything you're writing and everything you're putting on and everything that you're doing, you're so passionate about that it's you invested in it. So the rejection, I think, is harder. But any industry, you get rejected. You don't get that promotion. You have to work overtime. Maybe you get laid off. It's like any job, but you just need to make sure that you don't, it's not, you just need to remind yourself that it's not a personal attack on you with your rejection.
Yeah, I think, and certainly, you know, when you look at artists in our country, across the industry, there definitely becomes a waning of artists at a certain age. Mm-hmm. And that is, it is, I mean, I'm a single parent, and it is incredibly hard to justify time and again doing something that's only going to maybe pay a few peanuts. So it's kind of, it's fight. There is a bit of a balance required in there, and I do think that we are. I think that just the cost of living in New Zealand, no matter what industry you're in, is really high and really hard. And sometimes it does make you just want to throw it all in.
Mm. I just want to do a couple of shout outs here. It's election year. Okay. We've asked some of the political parties to come on Kick Arts and talk about the arts program. We did that 3 years ago in the last election. We had a National Labour and the Greens turn up. This year, they're not so keen on talking about the arts policies. I say to every artist, every writer, every quilt maker, every musician to look very carefully. If you're kind of going, well, I don't know which way I'll go, really. Bill's a nice guy. I just about said John then. Bill's a nice guy. I might vote that, or I like Helen. Oh, Andrew, you know, have a look. If you really are ambivalent, first of all, bloody well vote. Number one. If you don't vote, shut up. Second of all, have a look at the arts policy, how they're going to support the arts industry, the arts sector, our publishers, our writers, our musicians, everybody. How are we going to do it? What are you going to do? And ask your local MP. Go along to one of those meetings that only five people turn up to and be the person that asks those questions. Be informed, because that actually matters. The second thing, I'm going to play a public service announcement, give you a 30-second break, people. I talked about my co-host Georgia. She's not here tonight, but she's here in spirit. I'm just going to pay a little bit because we've got an important announcement to make here at Kick Arts from next week, and I'll just take it away here, and you can just have a little listen. The show's not finishing, so don't tune out when you hear this. Just listen to this. Another great show here at Kick Arts. Thanks to all our wonderful guests this evening. And I look forward to joining you, Georgia, my co-host, next week here at Kick Arts, 8:35 p.m.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock?
Yeah, 8 o'clock, Richard.
8 o'clock? It's 8:35.
No, it's changed now. It's 8 o'clock.
The time?
Yeah, did I not tell you?
No, you didn't. Why not?
Ooh.
Awkward. So Kick Arts is now on at 8 o'clock every Sunday night here at Planet FM from this coming Sunday?
Yeah.
Great. Anything else you'd like to tell me while we're at it?
Now that you're bringing it up, you know that shirt that you're wearing?
That's right. 8 o'clock from next week. We're going to be moving to 8 o'clock, which will be great because I'll be tucked up in my bed by 10 o'clock now, not like 11. I always leave the show. I've had such a good time with the guests on the show. You guys are fantastic. I get home and I'm like, oh, God. You like that once you've performed as well?
Yeah.
You've done something. Yeah. You just get that adrenaline buzz, don't you? You just go, whoa.
I'm currently playing an 8-year-old boy at Woe Studios in Henderson.
Oh.
So,
as a puppet.
Yeah.
I was going to say that's some scary 8-year-old genes.
I finished the show and my voice is an octave higher and I tend to say, hello, yeah, did you know the show? Yeah, so I'll watch that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you're doing that three times a day and then coming and doing Puppet Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
I just want to shout out to the Weber Brother Circus that's on at the moment in Ellerslie. Yeah. No animals. I checked it out. No animals. This is a New Zealand-based circus. I didn't know that. They're all New Zealand. The ring mistress, it doesn't sound right, does it, came out. The MC came out and announced, you know, welcome to the show. And it was all very, you know, almost a World of Wrestling kind of stuff. Are you ready? And she had this really strong Kiwi twang. I went, oh, hang on a second. My son goes, is this a New Zealand circus? I went, no. That'd be stupid. It is. And, my God, what an amazing 2 hours. If you're looking for something to do in the school holidays, if you've got children, or even if you haven't, go and see the Globe of Death. It's just so... Have you seen it? You're nodding your head. Yeah. The Globe of Death. It's so cheesy, but, my God, you're sitting there going, oh, my God, they're going to die.
I was 24 and I felt like I was 6.
Oh, yeah. And they're still going, and there's little kids in it, and the trapeze and the silk work and all that sort of stuff. Just incredible. It's on at Ellerslie Racecourse until the, I think, for another 5 weeks. And tickets from iTicket, go along and see it. So there's a shout-out for Weber. Wasn't really a review. I just wanted to mention it because I had such a good time. And I got some free popcorn as well, which was always awesome. And I have to say also, Ellerslie Racecourse got out of there in 5 minutes in the car park, as opposed to the Logan Campbell Centre the week before, which I've already mentioned, it took me 50 minutes after Jane Goodall to get out. They still haven't sorted their shit out. Okay, shameless promotion time, because there's a few of you. Shameless promotion time. I want to know where people can see your work, where they get tickets from, a brief, you know, how-to, what they expect, how long it is, and starting with 17-year-old Hannah.
Yeah, 17-year-old Hannah. I'm doing Summer Shakespeare in Fantasyland. Read by Richard Green. Puppet Fiction opens on Tuesday night at Basement Theatre. It's 8:30 p.m. every night. Tickets available at basementtheatre.co.nz.
Till Saturday?
Tuesday to Saturday. And if you don't catch us in the evening, you can catch John 3 times a day.
Yep, at Woe Studios. We've just opened up a new show.
Which it's is the Space Aliens, isn't it?
Yeah, Space Aliens from Outer Space. and it's a wild time. We're really proud of this one, I think. And at the moment, they're $20 tickets for the school holidays. We're doing 3 shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday.
And why
can't
I go on that?
Wine there? Like, as a grown-up, it's the best. You take your kids, right?
Yeah.
And you can buy a glass of wine, huh? And there's a playground and a show. As a parent, I'm like, this is like fancy McDonald's.
What annoyed me
so
was they
great.
Wouldn't let me on that playground with my wine.
Well, talk to me. I'll tell you.
I'll hook you out. Okay. Paula. How can we see these poems? Is there a? It's just a day, isn't it? Or just a day? It's not just a day.
Yeah,
but
National Poetry Day itself is Friday the 25th. On the National Poetry Day website or Facebook page, you'll see events going on all over the country in all sorts of weird and small places. Like last year, one happened in a life-saving club, all sorts of things.
Wow.
Some of the events go on around the day. They're not all on the Friday, so some things happen on other days. So have a look in your city where things are going on. Loads going on in Auckland. May I just also make one little plug for my book that's coming out this year?
You didn't say that. We have to come back and talk about it.
It's called False River, and it's a book about lying. And it's short stories and essays about lying.
Are you telling us the truth?
That's a good question. Well, I told my publisher a lot of lies when she wanted to have the manuscript was finished. But it's coming out. Penguin's bringing it out in November. So.
Well, how about you come back and talk to us about that.
About lying, I'd be very happy.
That'd be great. Yeah, don't lie to me now.
Would you?
Okay, Susie.
Yes, A Slightly Isolated Dog is doing Jekyll and Hyde for another week at The Basement. We're on Tuesday to Saturday at 8 p.m. Tickets are $25. It's a party with make-believe for adults with alcohol. So it's
sounds like every day at my house.
Yeah, it's super fast paced. It's about an hour and a half. There's a drinks break in the middle there. You're never sitting down for long. I think we hope to make something sexy and playful and explosive, and where you can come and we can celebrate all of the things that make us crazy and human and beautiful and insane and all of those things.
Can we bring some puppets down mid-show somewhere? Do a crossover?
Yeah, sure.
Right, all right.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's for anyone that we have a lot of people that have never been to the theatre before and they come along, and it's really live, and it's not trying to be Netflix. It's not trying to be fourth wall. It's really present. Yeah, thank God. Yes. Yeah, it's really trying to reach out, grab people and go, why are we doing theatre now, and how's it different to everything that we have?
And just quickly, why are you doing theatre? I never got that question for you.
Why?
30 seconds or less, where'd you start and how do you end up where?
Oh my goodness.
Put you on the spot, didn't
It's where I feel the most useful. It's where I feel the most productive is in a rehearsal room or in a performance space. I feel everything becomes really precise, and I'm feeling like that's where I'm best version of myself. And then the privilege of the show is that it's just so with people, and we are with the audience and interact with people and really get to connect and see the beautiful things that come out of people's mouths that they probably never thought they would say in public. And
that's why people come on Cocuts.
Yeah.
Well done, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. South Africans.
Yes,
I had to say that.
Doing my... Yeah, every time you say it, I get a dollar. Yeah. I am doing my solace show, The South Africans, with the word freak in the middle there, at The Basement, and it's running from the 15th to the 19th of August at 6:30 in the studio, and tickets are available from iticket.co.nz. It's 65 minutes long. I play a 65-year-old South African couple that immigrate from South Africa to New Zealand, based on my parents. They'll be there on opening night. Feel free to come along. Yeah.
So we can look at them and go.
You can look at them and go, yeah, you nailed them.
Nice, nice one, parents.
And, and you can find all our promotions and the trailer and all the interviews that we've been doing and all the press on our Facebook page, which is The South Africans, our Instagram, which is The South Africans. We're on Twitter. We're on YouTube. So do feel free to look us up.
Social media.
Give us a like. Yeah.
Give us a like. We say that to people. If they liked Kikats, give us a like. If they don't, send a friend. Send the show to a friend that didn't like us at all. That's what you should do, because you can download the show 5 minutes after we're off the air. You can download as a podcast. So if you don't really like someone and you didn't like the show, you can send it to them. Ahi, Ellen, talk about the film. I'm interested in the film. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
You've been talking so much, I didn't really ask you about the film stuff. So
no, that's fine. Really interesting topics. So just plugging for Short and Sweet, obviously. Short and Sweet, this will be on from 5th to 24th of September this year. You can still obviously submit your film. We're doing it through a platform called Film Freeway. But you can contact us at film@shortandsweet.org.nz if you have any questions. We're looking to as a curator for the film festival, I want at least, you know, more than 50% of the films to be from New Zealand. And for our first year, we want, actually, I think going forth as well, I had a long conversation about this with the overall festival team over in Australia. We want our judges' choice and people's choice to be both New Zealand films, so that we can really support our local creators. Brilliant. To take them to you know, the Hollywood big stage.
And so this is in September? You want the films
Auckland,
in now?
Yeah, so Short and Sweet Auckland since September. The Hollywood Boulevard, you know, that's for next year. But in between that, there's... so there's 6 Short and Sweet festivals this year and 15 next year. So if you submit your films, you're eligible for all of those festivals, mm-hmm. including obviously the main gala at Hollywood Boulevard next year.
Must so get my film in.
Great opportunities. Because I'm the last... do you have anything else to add, Tahi? Because I'm the last person, obviously, on the channel. I just want to say that I think... the arts sector, if you will, is actually really interconnected, because I mean, I come from a visual arts background, and I've had a lot of opportunities to collaborate with practitioners from literature and theatre and performance arts, and I think we're living in an age of golden age of independent creativity, and between all of these platforms, and it's a great way for us to actually reach audiences both locally and internationally. And I think Short and Sweet is obviously a great opportunity for that, but as well, like if there's traditional publishing or these infrastructures that they're holding us back, we definitely have a lot of opportunities that we can seek ourselves, whether it's crowdfunding, through Kickstarter or Patreon, like finding ways for your audience to find an audience and get an audience to support you. That is what we're going forward, and collaborating with other practitioners. I came on Short and Sweet because now I have opportunities to collaborate with other theatre makers, and I met the Proudly Asian Theatre guys through Short and Sweet, and then I had opportunity to illustrate the Cole Sparrow's the poster once it became a proper show, and then through that, obviously, I've able to work on the film side of things. So it's just really exciting, I think, for the arts to collaborate, and I think we could support each other to reach new audiences.
Absolutely, and often people leave the studio and they end up collaborating because they've seen each other's work and had a chat, and they come back and do some work together. We're one at a time. It is now the end of Kick-Ass.